This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rasky, and you're listening to Wage World, a Voice for the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wage World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at KABF.org, WAMF.org, or AcornRadio.org. A podcast will be available to show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wage World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Ann Kim, who's a contributing editor to Washington Monthly and has done the research and written a very interesting book called Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Welcome to Wage World, Ann.
Thank you so much for having me, Wade. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, and we want to hear more about, this problem. What a depressing book. So disconnected youth, what does that really mean? That's not a term many of us are as familiar with, although you've spent clearly a lot of time getting to the heart of it. What is disconnected youth?
Right. Disconnection is when a young person is not in school nor working. So the disconnection is actually literal. You're cut off from mainstream economic opportunity. And, you know, I wrote this book before the pandemic. I don't think anyone of us could have predicted that.
Absolutely.
But before the pandemic, you had, you know, as many as 4.5 million young people between the ages of 16 and 24 who are in this disconnected state, not in school, not working, you know, really falling behind and off the radar of the national conversation about, you know, who has access to opportunity, inequality, and the future of economic prosperity. Now I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about this connection because there are so many more young people who have suddenly been thrown out of school, definitely have fewer work prospects, and, you know, we can dive into some of the details of that, but I suspect that this connection is something we'll be hearing a lot more of, probably before the pandemic, now really into crisis proportions, I think.
Well, and it's interesting that in the U.S., we're sort of coming to grips with this very simple term, but I noticed in Europe this is a common expression. What was the abbreviation there?
Yeah, NEETs, not in employment, education, or training. That is the term used by the United Kingdom, which began actually measuring the share of young people who are out of school, out of work, as far back as 1999. And OECD, the Organization of Industrialized Nations, has been keeping track of this figure as well. So, you know, on many measures about worker well-being, the United States is, as you know, far behind other nations, and this is no exception. The thing about measuring needs is that these other countries that keep track of how young people are doing have a good sense of, you know, what it is that needs to be done to make sure that youth unemployment is monitored and dealt with and resources, you know, directed in that way. It's pretty disgraceful failing, I think, on the part of the United States that we haven't really kept a close eye on what is happening with young people and their chances, given how important that is for, you know, the future of the workforce.
Without measuring, it's hard to have good policy recommendations.
Exactly.
Do any of the states do a better job here in the U.S., Ann?
No, you know, the Census Bureau doesn't keep track of this figure at all.
Like I said, this is a depressing book.
Yeah, yeah.
Worth reading, yeah. But be ready to learn some stuff you don't want to know.
I know. It seems like we're surrounded by bad news, and I'm just here adding on to it.
Yeah, there you go. No, I'm in the bad news business as well. So, let's just plow through. So they aren't doing well. That's a shame. But obviously, part of what we hope happens as people look at your book and this general crisis is that more people will look at this problem. I mean, gee, I mean, from 18 to 24 and then on up to 35, you think about young people who've gone through, I mean, in the last 20 years in New Orleans, for example, Katrina, then the Great Recession, now the pandemic depression. Okay, so if they don't come from New Orleans, they didn't go through Katrina. But what prospects do young people, you know, even up to 35, have these days who are looking at one recession and now a depression? As soon as we get out of one, seems like there's clear sailing, we're in another problem. And then these youth, they're even in worse shape, aren't they?
They will be. You know, even before all this happened, by this question of a measurement, there's a fantastic nonprofit called The Measure of America. They have a map online that tells you where the rates of youth disconnection were highest pre, you know, pandemic. And, you know, unfortunately, the American South has some of the highest rates of disconnection. So even before all of this, about 16% of Louisiana young people were out of school and out of work, which is higher, significantly higher than the national average of 11%. And when you add in the fact that, you know, one out of four low-wage workers is between the ages of 18 and 24, and then you saw the new Fed report talking about how 40% of low-wage workers have lost their jobs as a result of this. You put that all together, and we don't know the numbers yet. It may be a while before we do, but the prospects for young people have absolutely cratered, especially for those who are growing up in parts of the country where it's the infrastructure of opportunity kind of didn't exist to begin with. You know, we have so many structural barriers that were already standing in the way of young people of color, young people from, you know, neighborhoods where they don't have access to the best education or the best opportunities to build social capital. And we have just, this virus has destroyed opportunities for those young people even more. And how we recover, when we recover, is that much more important to ensure that we don't bake in even further these structural disadvantages that already existed before this pandemic. I do worry that some of these structural disadvantages are going to be ignored because there's so much attention that has to go toward the immediate recovery efforts that are,
indeed,
that are going to have to be made.
And in your book, I mean, one of the things that, you know, caught my eye, so many of these, I mean, there was a chart that you included from Measure of America about the 10 most disconnected counties, overwhelmingly rural, which means the barriers solution are even higher given depopulation, deindustrialization. But it was a little bit, the shoes were tight. Louisiana was the worst, East Carroll Parish up in the north. A couple of West Texas counties that I know pretty well, Childress and Madison, were in the list. Lincoln County in Arkansas, this is part of our listening area. And then Tallahatchie County, not far from Greenville, where WDSV is located, another one of our stations in our listening area. And that's five of the top 10. Oh, mercy.
Yeah. No, it's things are pretty dire. And granted, because these are rural counties, the absolute numbers of young people might not be too high. On the other hand, we're talking about counties where, you know, one out of three young people is disconnected in this way. And, you know, every young person counts. You know, one out of three young people anywhere, that's too many to be out of school and out of work in this way. And I have to think that some of this has to do with, well, a lot of it has to do with public policies and the way we have, as I mentioned in the book, abandoned young people as a matter of public policy. And there are a couple of reasons we can talk about for why that is. But where the jobs are has become so much more important, like where you live. You know, you hear a lot about zip code determining destiny. And the maps on Measure of America and the maps are in the book show you that where you have the fortune or misfortune to live really does determine whether you're going to be a disconnected young person or not. And I think it's going to be even more true in the years to come as we all try to pull ourselves out of what this pandemic has wrought.
And do, at this point, without better public policies, is there really any choice in these terrible counties other than if you stay, you're caught in the swamp, and if you must have to leave to have a chance? It seems like they're almost, the lack of policy is almost forcing depopulation of young people from these areas.
No, I think that's right. And, you know, you would know better, you can tell, you would know better than I do how things are going in Louisiana. But the irony is that those who leave are the ones who are the best positioned to do so and more likely to succeed anyway. So you have this widening gulf between those who are facing the most barriers, including the opportunity to get away to places where there might be better jobs or better education available, and those who may be growing up in circumstances that make it impossible for them to seek, you know, opportunities elsewhere. And I think that means that we need public policies that will ensure that opportunities can come to young people wherever they are, not vice versa. It's too much to ask for a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old to figure out, you know, how they're going to get a job or an education without the means or without the support, emotional, financial, or otherwise, to make their own way. It's just not realistic to expect that, and we don't expect that of middle-class and upper-middle-class kids. That's the thing. You know, one of the things we talk about in the book is this gulf between the amount of investment that middle-class and upper-middle-class parents pour into their young people, supporting them all the way up until, you know, 30 and beyond, and then you have another group of young people who are essentially cut off from any sort of support from the day they, you know, from the day they're 18 or sooner, depending upon their circumstances. Particularly if you're caught in the criminal justice system or the foster care system, that abandonment is quite abrupt and has catastrophic consequences.
I mean, we are talking about a huge divide. I saw the term the other day, adolescence.
Yep.
This notion of adolescence moving on into your, you know, adult years, into almost your 30s, which is exactly what you're referring to, versus, you know, these disconnected youth. We're talking to Ann Kim, who's a contributing editor of Washington Monthly, a well-known political and other journal of national politics and local affairs in Washington, and the author of a recent book we're talking about called Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Ann, am I wrong? Wasn't there something over the last, I know there have been some articles over the last 10 years about mobility, though, is actually decreasing in America, I can't even say the word today. What's happening? But you know what I'm talking about. Demographers are saying that mobility is actually going down in the U.S., which is unusual, isn't it?
No, that's absolutely right. You know, back in a few generations past, it was possible to, you know, seek your fortune in the big city and think about, like, large migrations nationally from disadvantage to opportunity. And it's absolutely right. The tendency has been for people to stay put. You know, some of that has to do with housing crisis, you know,
right.
High home prices in parts of the country where the best jobs are. It's impossible. It's important. You can't afford to go live there. So what's happening is that the structural disadvantages that we've been talking about are really becoming baked in, really calcified. You know, when there is no mobility, there is no opportunity. And as the jobs disappear from rural America in particular, you have an even more hardening, even more calcification of these trends and of places that have it all and places that have nothing. And we've already seen the political consequences of this kind of economic anxiety spread throughout the country. And I think that, you know, there's been a lot written about how the pandemic has already these divisions and who has access to opportunity and who does not. And that's only going to get worse. If you are a young person whose parents are privileged enough to be able to work at home, you can still get that virtual internship, or you have the education, you can get that virtual job. And maybe, you know, maybe the connections you build won't be as good as going somewhere like, say, to Washington for an internship in your congressman's office. Maybe it won't be quite as robust as having those in-person connections. But, you know, you're going to be in a much better place than someone who doesn't have access to Wi-Fi, doesn't have access to decent education at all during these very crucial years when that first job really matters. And those first connections that you make really do matter. And that gulf is going to play out throughout the working lives of these young people as they go into their 20s, 30s, 40s, and even beyond, just in terms of what they're able to earn and the kinds of jobs they're going to be able to get.
Well, and it's impossible for us to ignore this speculation about what this pandemic will mean, and you've opened the door, so I guess we have to walk through it. We're all sick of the pandemic already, and we're going to be living with it for so long. But everything you said about disconnected youth is bound to be worsened by this economic depression, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that a population of young people who had not expected to become disconnected are going to be finding themselves that way. You know, I was looking at some of the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers on, you know, retail and the restaurant industry, and 30% of servers are between the ages of 20 to 24, you know, and one in five retail workers is within that age group. So all these young people who had not expected to find themselves, you know, suddenly out of work, and these, a lot of these kids are probably not in school either at this point, are suddenly in this category of disconnected. And what are public policies going to be to help young people in particular? You know, we're actually not talking right now in the public policy debate about young people per se. And we never invested very much in young people to begin with. That is one of the major failings that the book tries to point out. You know, the amount of federal investment we put in to reconnecting young people into, you know, job opportunities or educational opportunities who are disconnected is already shamefully low. And I do think that one of the things we should be discussing as we talk about CARES Act 4.0 or whatever phase we're in is, what are we doing for this very large population now of young people to maximize the opportunities they will have, whatever they may be, in the coming years? Because we are going to pay the price 10 years from now if we allow this group of young people to remain disconnected for an extended period of time, even if the rest of the economy manages to reopen. Although I have my doubts about how quickly that'll happen, but that's another discussion.
Well, I mean, there's just one bad topic after another, but I mean, places like, and certainly, you know, New Orleans has 25% unemployment. That's what they're recording. So, you know, it's probably closer to 35 or whatever. Once you talk about people who are already discouraged, but hospitality, tourism, the service industry, restaurants, whether you're in Arkansas or Washington or Texas or wherever you are, you know, small businesses have been huge employers in those kinds of service industries. And there's a lot of small businesses that, I mean, this PPP, these various programs have been disastrous in terms of, when they aren't disastrous, they seem scandalous. But to the degree the ethic has been small business creates jobs, those jobs aren't going to be there. You know, so I don't know. I mean, these sort of first entry jobs for people with high school education and for many lower middle income students who are trying to both work and go to school, which is very common and throughout the country in terms of youth. I mean, they're not going to have those jobs. I don't know how they're going to stay in school when they can't catch a couple of shifts as a barista or, you know, behind a bar somewhere or whatever, you name it, working, you know, during the Christmas rush at malls. I'm not sure there's going to be much of a rush at malls anymore.
I don't think so.
I'm not even sure there's going to be malls, Ann.
No, I agree with you. And two other things that I worry about with unemployment rates being so high is what's going to happen with, A, job quality, and, B, job safety. You know, back when we did have, you know, we're blessed with a very low unemployment rate, nominal unemployment rate, workers had a lot more leverage to demand, you know, some increase in wages. And we were actually starting to see a tiny bit of that before all of this happened. But now that we have an oversupply of workers, employers have got all the leverage now, and there's a lot less incentive to treat those who are coming in the door with the kinds of benefits and protections that they need. The cross current, you know, talking about how so many young people have been on the front lines of unemployment, especially in the retail and service sector. But there's also a perception that younger people are less vulnerable to the severe effects of the virus. And so that could mean that young people are under greater pressure now to take on jobs that are going to be higher risk. And do young people have the leverage and the organizing savvy to ensure that they are going to be protected if they're going to be taking on more of these frontline workers? I don't know. That is something that concerns me a lot, that we're going to be in a position where young people are going to be very, very vulnerable. If they're not employed, then they're going to be pushed into jobs that carry higher risk because of their perceived invulnerability to a virus is much more likely to have severe effects on older people. And so either way, young people are going to have it rough in the coming years, and that concerns me a lot.
Hire 100,000 trackers. We don't even want to guess how many of those will be in this demographic you're talking about. And tracking the virus is putting yourself at risk. I mean, you're talking to people who you know are likely to have been contacted and who may, in fact, be, you know, asymptomatic and carrying. We're talking to Ann Kim, who's a journalist and lawyer in the Washington, D.C. area and has written a very interesting and disturbing book, Abandon, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. Let's try to move to some more positive area. Ann, you had you finished strong in the book with a number of recommendations for where policy should move, regardless of a pandemic, let's say. Let's talk about some of those things to try to get people focused here.
Sure. So I do have an agenda for youth, and I think it is, you know, for the most part, still relevant, even perhaps even more relevant in the post-pandemic recovery phase that we're moving into. And this is an issue that should have no ideological biases. This is something that both Republicans and Democrats should be able to get around, left or right. The future of young people really does matter. And the first recommendation I have is a pretty simple one, and it gets back to something that you pointed out early on in this conversation, Wade, which is we need to keep track of the number of young people who are in this category. You know, Europe and the rest of the world are far ahead of us on focusing on the topic of youth unemployment. And so that's the first thing we can do. This is a census year. Let's ask, you know, are you a young person between the ages of 16 and 24 who's out of school and out of work? And let's get that NEET number established in the United States so we have some sense of what we're dealing with. You know, they say that if you don't measure it, it doesn't exist. And that's unfortunately the case in the United States right now. And that's the easiest thing to change. Second, you know, as long as we are going to be investing a lot of money in the recovery, let's think about focusing some of that money on the particular needs of young people who are taking a disproportionate brunt of the unemployment caused by the pandemic, thinking about what are these jobs of the future, how do we make them safe, and what kind of training are young people going to need to retool themselves. And the face of education is changing in real time as we speak. Part of that reform needs to be about how do you reach out in particular to young people who might have been inclined to drop out of a traditional educational setting and to ensure that that disengagement from education isn't exacerbated by having to go, you know, online. I think the risks are high there.
Is there any way that, do you see the education department moving in that direction at all, Anne?
Not this education.
No, wow. I mean, I'm still, you know, in shock reading the papers this morning about how Secretary DeVos has tried to divert resources. But, I mean, you mentioned in this recommendation in your book a program the National Guard has involved with, and you'd think that there were some, you know, the federal government should lead here.
You would think. Unfortunately, every possible opportunity that this government has been given to lead, they have either flubbed it, you know, catastrophically, or disavowed any responsibility, or, you know, misled the public on what it has done to cover up for these just monumental errors, start to finish. I don't believe that we're going to be able to get back on our feet unless we have a change in administration. And I sincerely hope that the American people will see that come November, so that some of these long-term structural problems that we've got to deal with will finally be dealt with in some programmatic and systematic and thoughtful way, which is the opposite of what this administration has done.
Well, and you would have thought even in this administration, given the, you know, its argument about its base in rural areas, that your recommendation about bringing opportunity to people would have resonated. But do you see any programs in that area that have promise?
You know, the administration, to its credit, small credit, has made noises about investing in apprenticeship programs and other work-based learning programs, which, you know, have shown a huge amount of promise in giving young people relevant skills in high-demand jobs. Unfortunately, it has been just noises. And one other thing that we will have to reconsider with the pandemic is how you retool apprenticeships, how you retool career tech education that requires hands-on learning. It's hard to do. It's hard to have a socially distanced apprenticeship program these days. And there's going to be a lot of rethinking, I think, but I certainly hope that the interest that has been generated in apprenticeship programs doesn't go away because of the new realities of the pandemic.
It's a good time to be a robot.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Which doesn't help us in our argument for young people or any people, really.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can just imagine on any kind of factory job, I mean, the calculations even in meatpacking, which has been low entry and immigrant-based, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to see robots going crazy in there, I would bet. I mean, what do I know? But I would bet safely on that in that direction.
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, there was a Brookings analysis I saw fairly recently predicting exactly what you're saying, that the pace of automation is going to accelerate because that is what businesses will see is the safest route to ramping up demand without using workers. And so what does that mean? That means fewer opportunities for all workers, but especially young people.
How did you get involved in this whole disconnected youth, Anne?
Well, you know, I've been studying this question of opportunity and who has access to it and who does not.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in social policy for quite some time, and I was fortunate to have the support of the Annie Casey Foundation in doing a deep dive into this particular topic and to, you know, write a book that brings to light some of the most promising options for reconnecting and keeping young people connected. And so I know we've talked a lot about the negative aspects of this problem, but the back third of the book does profile programs that I think have done a really excellent job of providing young people with the mentorship, the resources, the connections, the job opportunities that they need. And you can read success stories there, and I'm hoping that those success stories do not get lost in the discussion we're going to have in coming years about how it is we rebuild our nation, and perhaps we do have an opportunity ahead of us to radically rethink how we teach, whom we teach, and how to close some of the gaps that have threatened to tear our country apart over the last few years.
Well, there's also, you know, the notion that in chaos, there's also opportunity. It is certainly the case that we are in chaos now. So let's see if we can find opportunity, if there's rethinking. I'm sure you're already looking, and certainly Annie B. Casey has been at the forefront of programs for youth for a long time through the various Casey Foundations. We've been talking to Ann Kim about your book, Abandoned, America's Lost Youth and the Crisis of Disconnection. We need people to read this book, and how do people get a hold of it?
So it is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart.com, et cetera. But I very much hope that folks will go to IndieBound and support their local independent bookseller, because the book is available through there as well.
Repeat that. Is there a website there, IndieBound?
You can find me on IndieBound, but my website, my personal website, okay, is anneskim.com. And you can also find me on Goodreads as well. You can find some opportunities to find the book via Goodreads.
anneskim.com. And if any of the listeners have want to follow up and have other questions, there's probably a way for them to ask that on your website as well, Anne?
Yes, absolutely.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard. And as Lucinda Williams sings, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wage World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke for Wage World. Thank you.